Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So what if everything you think you know about weight loss and obesity was turned on its head? And what if dieting were a waste of time? And hey, a little fat won't kill you. It might even help you live longer. Well, that's a very rough approximation of New York Times science writer Gina Colada's new book, Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dying. And she joins me now. Gina, great to have you back on WNYC.
It's
good morning.
It's wonderful to be back again. Thank you so much.
I think the big shock in the book maybe is that the research is there and has been there for years, showing that it's next to impossible for people to change their basic weight. You can't lose a lot of weight. You can't gain a lot of weight. Is that right?
It is. Well, what the research has been showing for years and years is that everybody has a range of weights that their body is comfortable in, and that it's a genetically determined range of weights. So people have adopted children end up with the weights of their biological parents, even if they never knew them. Now, it doesn't mean that you are destined to weigh 140 pounds and you can't veer from that. It means you may be able to weigh like 130 to 160 or so. But if you try to go below your genetically determined weight range, your body sort of fights back and your metabolism slows down. You become obsessed with food. There's a drive to eat that's as strong as any drive in the world. If you go try to get above your range, people who tried to gain weight, often in scientific experiments, it was very, very difficult because they got to the top of their range and their metabolism really speeded up, like by 25%. It speeded up as much as it slowed down at the other end of the range. And then they food was disgusting to them. It's like after Thanksgiving dinner and someone says, how would you like to have another dinner after this? You say, oh, no, I can't. Well, that's how they felt every day when they looked at food.
Well, this sounds incredibly fatalistic. Are you really saying there is nothing we can do as adults about our weight because either it's genetic or our eating habits are hardwired by then?
It's a very difficult situation because society is saying, or fashion is saying, there's a certain weight that looks good, that you should be. That should be, everybody should aim for this kind of a weight range. And yet the reality is that most people can't get below a certain weight and hold it there. I mean, they may get there, but they pop back up again. And so what happens is it's not that you can't lose, people can never lose weight. They can lose weight, often like 20, 30, 40 pounds and hold it. And it's not that losing weight can't make some people healthier. And it's not that they might not feel better when they're towards the bottom of their range than when they're towards the top of their range. It's just that the expectations that have been put on people are unrealistic, and the prejudice and the discrimination and sort of the constant disgrace that people feel for not fitting into this mold is kind of unconscionable.
So you think that we've confused a sort of moralizing about food and weight with science and health?
Well, one person calls it a moral panic. They say we have a moral panic going on about weight these days. And I thought that was a really good term because it's not so much about health. It's really a lot about what people think you should look like.
Gina Colada, my guest on WNYC, the New York Times science writer. Her new book is Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dieting. How far do you take this? Are you suggesting, I mean, and I read a bunch of the book. I see it's very scientific. You cite study after study after study after study. Are you saying that the science suggests that we shouldn't even bother to exercise or use willpower over that piece of chocolate cake?
Science has been developing for years and years, and it showed pretty conclusively what I just mentioned about the weight range. It also shows that exercise can help many people to do things like control their blood sugar. There was a big study trying to get people who were overweight and on the verge of diabetes to not get diabetes. And this is a big study. They threw everything at these people you could ever throw at them. And it turned out that most of them could not hold a weight loss, or not much of a weight loss, but they could continue to moderately exercise, and that made a big difference in their health. So it's not that exercise doesn't work. And also, there is such, when people say, is there such a thing as willpower if you have this drive to eat? Well, yes, you there is within to a certain extent. You can control your weight within the range that your body is comfortable with. But you really can't go that much below it, and that's why most people have these dream weights on diets. This is what I'd really like to weigh. This is the real me. They feel like they beat themselves up. They say, oh, I'm such a failure. I was doing so great. I got down there, and then I went up again. I don't know what happened.
If there's so much science to back this up, why don't we see this in magazines, in the popular press? Why don't we see it in women's magazines? Why don't all these diet fads, you know, get knocked instead of promoted?
You know, what's really interesting is the diet fads have been around for so long, you wouldn't believe it. The original Atkins diet was invented in the early 1800s by a food writer who became very famous, wrote a best-selling book, but it really took off at the end of the 1800s when it was rediscovered by an undertaker who lost weight on it. And he wrote a book. His name was William Banting. And it became so famous, it was an international bestseller, that the word for dieting became Banting.
And I love learning from your book about the role that technology has played over time in dieting and even getting people interested in dieting, meaning scales, mirrors, photography. So you're saying no one cared about being fat if they didn't have to see themselves?
I love the fact that you asked this question. Because I thought it was fascinating. People were obsessed with their weight, and people would go to things like these hanging scales that they would use for grain to weigh themselves. But what really sort of got this obsession, real obsession, with how much do you weigh and what do you look like going, were these little technologies. You got to look at yourself in a full-length mirror in the early 1900s. They used to be very expensive, and no one really had them. You could see photographs of people instead of just drawings in newspapers and magazines, because photography improved. So now you can see what you should look like. You can see the mirror to see what you do look like. And then bathroom scales sort of came in. At first, they just had scales in public places with chimes that would ring when you stood on them, and that was kind of embarrassing. Then the scale makers figured it out, and they started advertising sort of the people, women usually, in the privacy of their bathrooms, weighing themselves every day. So now you keep track of your weight, you could see what you look like, and you could see what you should look like. And there was messages like one book that was a best-selling book was in 1916, I believe, was called How to Live. And they told people that How to Live. Yes.
Just think about that for a minute. It's the ultimate self-help book.
It is, but they said, the reduction of weight is really a very simple matter. No mysterious or elaborate systems or drugs are needed. If reduction in the amount of energy, food, and increase in the amount of exercise is made, no power on earth can prevent a reduction in weight. Same thing we always hear, eat less, exercise more, 1916. If it worked, we'd all be thin.
Gina Colotta, New York Times science writer, my guest on WNYC. Her new book, Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dieting. It's published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. You're not suggesting, are you, that we don't have an obesity epidemic in this country? I mean, you talked about genetics and how we're likely to be, you know, relatively in the same weight range as our parents. But I think we see over time that people are on average, in this country at least, fatter today than they were 40 years ago, than they were 70 years ago.
People are fatter today, and I think every geneticist would say that genes and environment interact. People on average are about 5 to 7 pounds heavier than they were about 20 years ago. And at the top end of the scale, they're more like 25 pounds heavier. They're very obese or even heavier than that. So the real question is not, are there genes involved? There are genes involved. They're setting a range. The question is, why are people moving up and they're genetically to sort of almost be as fat as they could be? And the answer is that nobody really knows. There's all sorts of hypotheses. It's the bigger portion sizes. It's the high fructose corn syrup. It's this, it's that. But it turns out that every one of these things are just hypotheses without any rigorous evidence. What's interesting to me is I feel every single day, it seems like, I hear from another researcher who has decided to look back farther in earlier in time to ask what's been going on. The big push these days is to look at prenatal influences. In animals, it's pretty easy to change the weight of an adult by changing the environment during pregnancy, prenatally. And in humans, there's lots of evidence the same kind of thing can happen. For example, about 15 studies have shown that if a woman smokes during pregnancy, her child as an adult becomes fatter. So people are saying maybe we've been looking in the wrong places. But that's what makes it so hard to figure out what in the environment. Like, where do you look? Do you look in prenatal life? Do you look into a teenager? Do you look at kids? Do you look at adults? Where does this all happen?
Right. So science, I guess, will continue to dig in on that to see if there's something in early childhood or even prenatally, as you say, that parents can do to help prevent their children from being overweight. But once we get, it's still very fatalistic, because then once we get past like the age of one, we're determined to be in a certain weight range.
But I think that you can look at it more than one way. You can say, isn't it kind of liberating to say, I'm not a total failure. I'm not this miserable human being because I can't get down to some weight that society says is the right weight for me. Isn't it better to say, I know where my body is comfortable. This is where I'm healthy. This is where I can be fit. This is where I can look really good. I can buy clothes. I can look fine. I don't have to say that. I don't have to spend my entire life saying, if only I could lose 40 pounds, then I would be, that would be the real me.
But I think it's important to try and separate out cosmetic from health and longevity concerns. So if you're trying to empower people with this, to not so harshly judge themselves because people say they're failures for not losing weight when really there's a set point that's just them, are you also saying that we can't do much about the early heart disease or adult diabetes that's also associated with extra weight?
Well, you know, the thing is that when people looked at the question of where is the weight range that is associated with the longest life, turns out to be the so-called overweight range, which is a shock. But there's been more than one study that showed that, and most recently was a very rigorous one using national data.
What do you mean the overweight range?
Well, we have these ranges that are sort of set almost arbitrarily. What's normal? What's underweight? What's overweight? What's obese? And if you look at the mortality curve, the death rate curve, it's shaped like a U, and the bottom of the U is the overweight range, which is kind of weird. And people say, well, how come overweight people live longer? It turns out that no one really knows. Again, it's always the same answer, no one knows. But one hypothesis is that when people get older and they end up with some chronic illnesses, cancer, heart disease or something, they often can't eat as much. And if you're very thin, you end up with sort of losing more weight. You lose an unhealthy amount of weight. But it's not entirely clear why. But the other thing is about losing weight and health is that often what happens is there's one guy described it recently to me as a tipping point with diabetes, for example. That's the biggest health risk with overweight. And that's only in genetically predisposed people. There's a huge genetic influence on diabetes. But if you're genetically predisposed to get diabetes, there's often like a weight at which your blood sugar starts to go up. And if you get below that weight, it gets normal again. And the tipping point for you might be 240 pounds, which might look obese, but at 230 pounds, you're fine. You still look obese, but you're fine. So it's you don't always have to, and often you'll see big gains in things like blood sugar without getting down to the so-called normal weight range.
But this is a revolutionary idea that heavier weights up to a certain point actually protect us from disease.
Yes, and you know, it's sort of, and I look at you and I think of me, and you and I are not actually in a good situation here.
We're a little skinny meringues.
Yeah. So it's sort of funny, you know, to say, well, maybe you're better off, but I'm not sure that people are obsessed with their weights because disease is always what people state, and it's in the back of their minds. But when people, like a friend of mine who says she can't buy clothes because this isn't the real her, she may say to you, I'm worried about maybe my health will get bad, but what also bothers her, she looks in the mirror and she says, this isn't what you should look like.
Right. But I also work out regularly, and I'm thinner than people in my family who have very similar genetics. So, you know, activity means something. And when you look at the demographics, don't more affluent and more educated people tend to be thinner than poorer and less educated people?
They absolutely do. And this has been something that's been noticed for years and years and years. There's a real social gradient. And in fact, some people who are talking about this moral panic over obesity say that it's not a coincidence that the people in the lower classes or lower social economic classes are fatter, because there are also people it's like an excuse to say, some people say, look at those slobs, they can't take care of themselves, they're fat, no wonder they're poor, which is a really outrageous situation. I want to say one thing about exercise, too, if you don't mind. People often say, well, if you just exercise, anybody would be thin if they exercise. And there's never been a study, to my knowledge, in which people only exercise, didn't do anything else, and exercise alone made a difference in their weight. My son, who's this fabulous runner, was training for the Boston Marathon, and he went from running 30 miles a week to running 100 miles a week. And you would say, gosh, he's going to just like drop so much weight. He lost about 3 pounds. He's a person who just eats when he's hungry.
So he started to eat more to compensate?
He said he didn't even realize he was. I guess he did. He said, I think my metabolism slowed down. He probably, without realizing it, just was eating like an extra apple, an extra piece of bread, an extra this, an extra that, and it just compensated.
But here's the question. Is somebody like that going to be less prone to heart disease? We talked about diabetes, but, you know, we always hear about the importance of diet and exercise to prevent at least the risk factors of heart disease. Is somebody who does that exercise going to still have lower cholesterol, lower blood pressure on average? And so that really means something, even if your ultimate weight is not going to change except within a small range.
It may be, but I'll have to say something about heart disease too, and that is that heart disease death rates and incidence rates have been plummeting for like 50 or 60 years. People are getting less heart disease than they ever used to get, and they're getting it at older ages. In fact, we talk a lot about the health crisis in this country, but every chronic disease is occurring less frequently at older ages, and disability rates are continuing to drop and drop and drop, and we're living longer and longer and longer, even though we're fatter and fatter and fatter.
So we're almost out of time, but one of your takeaway messages is obviously, if you've tried to lose weight and you can't, don't judge yourself a failure, and don't let others judge you a failure. And everyone else, don't judge them a failure, because a lot of this has to do with a genetic set point.
If I could remake society, that would be my message.
But what about the takeaway message for everyone else? What should that 20 pounds overweight listener do when confronted this weekend with that ice cream sundae?
You can control yourself in the short term and not have that ice cream sundae, but you have to realize that these controls over your weight act in the long term. And so if you don't have that ice cream sundae and you say, my weight didn't change, it may be that these controls are making you eat an extra apple every day for the next 2 weeks.
A whole other way to look at the science and morality of weight. Gina Colata, New York Times science correspondent. Her new book is Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dieting, published by Farrar, Strauss, Giroux. Very eye-opening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will preview the summer movies, from Harry Potter and Spider-Man to finally a Simpsons movie after all these years, and some of the indies. So stay with us.